We are continuing with our invited testimony in our informational meetings. Today we are going to hear back from the facilitator of the Oregon Health Plan informal work group. I guess we call him Facilitator Barney Speight, who is the Director of Government Relations for Kaiser. He does not wear that hat today, nor does he wear that in the work groups, but he is going to give us a complete and as detailed as his memory possibly allows and our questions pry out of him presentation on the work group. So with no further ado, let me invite Barney to the witness stand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Barney Speight, Kaiser Permanente. I believe that the...
Where do you put it? Michael.
No, get it closer. That's a very bad mic.
Can you hear me now?
Okay. I can hear you.
Maybe pull the other one in close, too.
We'll get this triangulated and then... Okay. I believe... committee staff has given you a handout, and I'll work from that handout to give you an overview of what's transpired at the OHP work group or stakeholders work group this week. As I think you all realize, we started Monday and are meeting Monday and Wednesday for the next 3 weeks. The work group consists of, and I'll go through the roster so that you. You know who's been participating. Dr. Bruce Goldberg, whom you've heard here, the new director of the Oregon Health Policy and Research Office. John Powell, representing Regents. Tom Holt, representing the Oregon State Pharmacists Association. Jim Gardner, representing the pharmaceutical manufacturers.
Hold on half a second, Barry. Can you guys hear in the back? Are we doing okay?
Can't hear.
Here, pull the cords out.
There we go. Let me get it up now. Better? Okay, well, I'll talk up. Bill Murray, who is representing the fully capitated health plans. Mr. Murray is the CEO of an IPA in Coos Bay. Kevin Earls, representing the Hospital Association. Gene Thorne from DHS. Scott Gallant from the Oregon Medical Association. Rocky King, whom you've heard previously here from the Insurance Pool Governing Board. Steve Petrozelli from Willamette Dental, representing the dental care organizations. And Ellen Lowe, a consumer advocate who's been participating in the Oregon Health Plan development and management almost from the beginning. We've had excellent attendance. Everybody has attended. We've had excellent staff support from both.
From who?
From both Mr. Bracobian and the LFO staff, Mr. Britton, and others. And so I will kind of walk through what we've done in about. We met about for about an hour and a half Monday night because of the hello party, and then about 2 hours last night. So we've got about three and a half hours of group work under our belt. The first meeting, you'll see the handout that says OHP Stakeholder Group that has a staple in it. The top sheet was the handout for the first night that really laid out and Chair Westland and Chair Cruz and Chair Winters were there and went through what the goal of this stakeholder group was and then the process that we would use and what we would hope to achieve over the six meetings. And you can see that the first meeting was goals, process, framework for developing recommendations. And last night we dealt with some real numbers that I'll get into in a moment, and then we'll continue our work next Monday night. One of the products of the first meeting is separate from the staple sheet, which is we kind of worked on the concept that if we got through this process and looked back on the recommendations that we would deliver to you as the committee and would move forward through both policy committees and fiscal committees, how would we judge that we did a decent job And so we worked on what I call principles or standards, and you'll see there that there are 10 of them. And this was, again, a collective work group. It continues to say proposed draft because people are still reviewing them, but this was my attempt at trying to capture the conversation around these. And I'll just quickly run through these because I think that they're going to be useful throughout the process, regardless of who's looking at these policy issues. The first, and it probably is the most important, there is no hierarchy in these principles listed 1 through 10, but I would say that probably the first principle was the one that got on the table first and that I think there's very strong consensus about, and that is we are in a fiscal situation of dealing with prioritizing populations, and that the prioritization of the population has to be on some medical vulnerability or social vulnerability and medical vulnerability. And there's an example, for example, the elderly and the children. And this discussion of prioritizing populations, Chair Winters made clear was one of the bases of the work in the Ways and Means sub. The second is important because I think what we've learned through OHP standard and through the iterations of OHP standard, and Dr. Bates can clearly speak to this in more detail than I, but that is the benefit package, whatever we put it together, needs to be clinically realistic. We're assuming that the benefit package will not be as comprehensive as it's been in the past, but even with it being less comprehensive, it has to make sense to providers from a clinical point of view. It has to give clinical management opportunities, including selective preventive services that reflect medical effectiveness. And lastly, the credibility or the realistic nature of the benefits and the underlying payment for those benefits are really the two components that work together to keep providers plugged into the system. You could have reasonable payment even, but if the benefits don't make sense, the clinicians are going to be really frustrated. The third principle is that we talked about being open to and looking at a wide variety of financing and delivery options, both in the insurance model, for example, fee-for-service or various risk models. The fully capitated health plan is one type, or even looking at non-insurance models, for example, support for the safety net. Fourth, we continue to want to look at what we're buying with OHP dollars is improvement in health. We're not just buying health care. Health care services are a means to that end, not the end in themselves. And therefore, the group remains committed to the concept of a benefit prioritization, that is to pay for those benefits that work, and to not pay for benefits that don't seem to have based on scientific evidence, any efficacy. Fifth, we are cognizant that the work that we're doing and that the recommendations that we ultimately as a group will give to you are going to be viewed in the context of the larger or the historic OHP principles. Times have changed. We're in a rather unprecedented environment, and I think that a good thought was laid on the table is that if we can't make linkages to some of the past policy principles, then we need to explain clearly why we can't. We need to understand what perhaps principle or policy variation we're putting forth, and we need to make sure that our recommendations neither look in reality or in appearance as being arbitrary, that they are grounded in good policy, good medical policy, good fiscal policy, good social policy. Six, of course, is in the eye of the beholder, but there needs to be a sense of the recommendations we come back would need to be fair, equitable, proportionate, even-handed, and that's across the whole spectrum of stakeholders, consumers or clients, providers, the public generally. Leveraging of funds, of course, you've heard a lot about the federal match and others, and that's a key principle of being able to use that wherever possible. It's a very high priority because it allows us clearly to buy more medical services and to cover more people. The eighth is relates to a lot that you've heard about from the fully capitated health plans, and that there is a core infrastructure within the Oregon Health Plan that was developed through the Oregon Health Plan And whether you call it managed care or organized care or coordinated care or guided care, there are all sorts of different adjectives that you can put in front of this concept, but there's a belief that this is a core infrastructure that needs to be preserved to the greatest extent possible. And I've listed three reasons that I heard that night of why. One is that these organized systems or guided systems, whether they be at an IPA level or through a larger fully capitated health plan or in a plan, for example, like Kaiser Permanente, they do provide a basis for sound conservative medical management, development of evidence-based protocols, and the development of principles that have physician support and are used routinely. Secondly, the FCHPs and other models like them have in the past been able to provide some economic incentive to physicians who participate, because through the careful management of pharmaceuticals and other resource inputs, generally physician payments can be higher. And third, the thought really is looking to the future is the thought of if we have to make a rational contraction of the Oregon Health Plan, we need to be prepared for a rational re-expansion when times turn better, economic times turn better, and that the core infrastructure is really the base from which that new growth could occur. Hence, it needs to be preserved, again, to the extent possible. The ninth, we need to mitigate the shifting of costs. Quite candidly, I think everybody recognizes we're not going to eliminate it. We may not even... we hope to minimize it, but we know that different policy choices will play out differently relative to the cost shift, and we need to be aware of that. And the cost shift is also very broadly defined in this, because there's clearly the cost shift that we've heard a lot about is the unreimbursed costs or the under-reimbursed costs that are passed on through provider pricing to the commercial sector. But there's also cost shifting into, for example, other governmental entities, cities and counties, or into private nonprofit social and health agencies. So we need to be aware of that. And lastly, I think just to be very explicit about it, whatever we develop for the next 2 years and beyond, it needs to be functional. That is, it needs to work for those who are enrolled, and it needs to work for the providers who serve those who are enrolled, and it has to be sustainable. It has to be sustainable not only through this biennium, the 2003-05 biennium, but hopefully sustainable into the future, and again, a basis from which we can grow and expand as economic times turn better. And I would point out that these principles, they're not in a hierarchy. Really, the first statement at the top, within an unprecedented resource-constrained environment, and what Chair Westland continues to say to all of us appropriately, and that is we're operating within an existing revenue or existing resource paradigm. So think within the box relative to resources. And so we have to apply these principles in an environment that is quite unique for all of us. I'll stop it just briefly and take questions on this before I move into.
Now, I was going to say, Barney, let me stop you there. And this is kind of the first thing we did, developed a set of guidelines and operating principles. I appreciate Barney mentioning what are three absolutely key words in these whole discussions, and that is, almost at the end of every one of these, and I've been checking, you could almost do it grammatically on these 10 stakeholder group principles, is within existing resources. I mean, we're not playing games and we're not fooling anybody, and it's not, you know, some pie-in-the-sky exercise. We're trying to do as much as we possibly can with what we know is there. You know, we can all talk about different revenue proposals and, gee, if you'd only do this, that's a big if. And I'm not going to spend the amount of time that I'm spending. I'm not going to ask Barney to spend the amount of time he's working, as well as the other stakeholders with Representative Cruz, Representative Bates, to design something on an if. We are going to do what we can do, three keywords, within existing resources. Two things about a budget. How much is it? And then the other part that people always forget. How certain is it? When we're done, we want to be certain we can do what we say we're going to do. Anyway, not trying to be too heavy-handed on that, but I just want to stress that for everybody. Any questions from the committee for Mr. Spate on our principles? This is really the first thing we did. Any questions of the committee of Representative Bates, Cruz, or myself?
Great job summarizing.
Thank you.
Good job.
Yeah, and we came to these, I'd say, fairly collaboratively, fairly Tom Holt represents pharmacists. Has been spending, you know, a lot of time, not only in this committee, but he's up there every night. We're going to go back up tonight for mental health. It's a pretty arduous task that we've assigned ourselves, and I can't thank the stakeholders who've agreed to participate, the legislators, and in particular, and I appreciate you mentioning this, Barney, committee staff, both, you know, Mr. Bercovian to my right and LFO. I mean, these guys are putting in extra hours, and I think we should also mention some of the folks over at OMAP and DHS who've done some yeoman's work getting us as far as we've gotten.
Mr. Chair.
The,
Mona Sanderson.
Representative Cruz's staff, Sandy has been in there
yes.
pitching as well. So this has really been a team effort, and it's been very collaborative. I'm very proud of all of us that have been involved. So anyway, with those accolades and kudos, Representative Lori Mona Sanderson.
Thank you. Now, I know this is, we're dealing with the Oregon Health Plan, but it says the Oregon Health Plan stakeholder group. So when we go down to number 8, and I'm noticing that you say a possible economic incentive for physicians to participate, had you discussed about a possible economic incentive for employers to participate?
Chair no. Westland and
that would have been go ahead. If Barney, go take it first.
Representative Bones Anderson, what we're referencing there are the basically, I think for the purposes of the OHP work group, it would be the fully capitated health plans through which they contract with the state. In this situation, there are no employers involved because they serve exclusively Medicaid eligible people. Similar kinds of organizations exist for both in the dental care and also in mental health. They're specialized around those two modalities of healthcare, those three modalities of healthcare for the Medicaid population.
But why can't employers follow-up?
What I think they're trying to get there is physicians have to be incented enough to stay in the plan.
Right.
I mean,
I think I may care. Maybe just something struck with what you're referencing.
I think I what he's referencing. Go ahead.
By having these organizations working in communities in the Medicaid venue, and working in the area of what I would call evidence-based medicine and organized practice systems for Medicaid, I think there probably is a benefit for the larger commercial employer community, because many of those, if you will, medical standards or medical approaches that may be developed and ratified in the Medicaid community may become part of a community practice. So
that's not where I'm going.
Okay.
Yeah, follow up.
Representative Bates.
Representative Anderson, I believe you're asking, are we talking about incenting employers to take part in the OHP program?
Exactly.
I believe you're asking. I would tell you yes and no. Yes, we are not dropping the IFEOP program, which is the program that's set up to incent employers to take part in the Oregon Health Plan. And two, the way Medicaid is run and under the waivers we work, primary insurance is always your employer's insurance. If you work for an employee and you stay below the poverty levels we're speaking to here, and he doesn't, the employer doesn't supply health insurance, then you qualify for the Medicaid plan. Can we incent those people, those employers? Your question is, can we incent those employers to take part in the program? We would through the FEOP program still. So that has not been dropped. The FEOP
program
is
different.
It's still there. There's still money involved in it at this time. We're looking at that. But low-income people working for an employer who doesn't offer health insurance, the route is the FEOP program. Does that make sense?
And just one little follow-up.
Sure.
I was talking to a major fast food business this morning, and they had paid 80% of health insurance. Now it's down to 25%, and now OHP is, cut services also. So basically their employees, they don't have very many employees buying into the paying the premiums for the health for their health plan, and they're not really eligible now for their Oregon health plan also. And so I was thinking just of providing incentives for them to help pay for premiums to the Oregon health plan, and that's what you're saying FEOP does. That's where I was going with
Representative, that is what Representative Bates said is correct. We have Rocky King participating as a state resource along with the folks from DHS and OMAP, because FEOP is, under the current waiver, federally matched, and it is part of the Oregon Health Plan, and it will, I'm assuming, at some point be on the table for us to look at within this work group. But right now we're dealing with, if you will, the Medicaid portion of it.
Gotcha.
But I think that FEOP would be the mechanism or tool that would address the issue that you just raised.
Thank you.
Representative Bates.
Just a quick comment, Mr. Chair. It was fairly impressive by this work group how fast we got the work we just discussed and how that work has continued in our last meeting. And I think some of the reasons for that is that people have taken off their hats about who they are. They've put away their turf battles, and they have an atmosphere they can work in where they can float ideas without fear of it being broadcast to the entire Western world that somebody thought of something fairly stupid and said it out loud and not have it discussed. And the atmosphere we're working in, where we have some confidentiality, an opportunity to float ideas back and forth and have a discussion, is something I think is very important that we maintain at this time. And then come to this committee for debate about it. And one of the reasons we're making progress, I believe, is because of that, the way the chair has set this thing up, that we can work with all parties at that table in a very open way. And that's what's made this thing move forward. I am personally very impressed by the work this group has done so far to try to define the problem and be realistic about what the problem really is as far as the constraints we have by the budget. That is foremost in everybody's mind, thank you. And it's a significant conversation. I had people walk out of the meeting last night who had been working in the Oregon Health Plan for 15 years and said that was probably the best meeting they'd ever gone to for discussion of the plan. And that is a monumental statement considering all the meetings I've been concerned with this over the years.
Well, hey, we've got some good people, we've got some great legislators, and that open, friendly environment is what allows me to talk in that thing. Otherwise, I'd be afraid to make a fool of myself. Representative Cruz, you look like you want to say something. Mark it down. That's a little bit about a process. Those are the principles we've established. Loose guidelines we're working by. Continue to the next phase.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, let me take you into the next three handouts, and I'll get you there through the following logic. If we answer the question, does Oregon want to have a Medicaid program? If we answer that question in the affirmative, and there was unanimous consensus that the answer should be in the affirmative.
Could I phrase that state that question differently?
You may, Mr. Chair.
I think it's at the very least do we want to have a Medicaid
program. That's correct.
Program.
Okay. The minute you answer the question in the affirmative, then the it poses that there are mandatory requirements that the federal government imposes on participating states when they enter into the federal-state partnership called Medicaid. And so the work group is really starting from the foundation of trying to understand, both from a eligibility point of view and also from a benefit cost point of view, what would the base look like of a mandatory Medicaid program, and from that base then move beyond it. The information that you have before you, the first page I believe is a chart, breaks down the 0305 total estimated caseload into two subgroups. One, those that are mandatory in the top half, and you can see that totals to about 350,000 rounded, and then the optional populations, optional in the sense that the federal government does not require a state to cover persons in these categories to receive federal match, and those total about 150,000. So for our first step in this process of looking at how we manage within existing resources the Oregon Health Plan for 0305 is to try to get a handle on how much resource would it take to deliver to that 348,000 mandatory populations the mandatory minimum benefits that are required by the federal government. And the mandatory minimum benefits, very briefly, are physician services, inpatient and outpatient hospital services, and that's about it. There's some other minor stuff, but to point out, the mandatory minimum requirements of the federal government do not include prescription drugs. Now, I would point out, we all realize that there is no state in the union that has a Medicaid program running today that doesn't have prescription drugs, but we're starting from that base, if you will, of let's look at the mandatory minimums. So now let me take you to this sheet that is the price.
Is everyone comfortable and understand what Barney was saying about the top? That's the mandatory federal minimum Medicaid populations. That's what has to be covered up to the minimum poverty level. Down below, the second box, are populations that are being left out under what we are currently covering.
Let me give you an example.
Hold on.
Okay. That's our current standard population.
He spoke it wrong ago.
This is the lower one.
Yeah. Let Barney correct my error.
Well, I'm just going to point out that, for example, when you look at the second, third, and fourth rows, where it's children, TANF and PLN children, you'll note that the federal requirement is that we have to cover children under the age of six in families of up to 133% of the federal poverty level. We have to cover children between the ages of 6 and 18 under the federal minimum up to 100%. But if you drop down and look at the optional population, you can see that we're actually covering children up to 185% by using another program called CHIP, which is optional. So we are, if you will, segmenting these populations and getting estimates of how large they are based upon the mandatory, and then we will go back and look at the other populations and the costs associated with those. I'm just using that as an example. And you can see on this chart, this gives you a little idea that in some of the populations, for example, the PLMW, the pregnant poverty level medical for pregnant women, we, under the current waiver, we are serving pregnant women up to 185%, but the federal, if you look down the third line from the bottom, the PLM adults, the requirement is only to serve them to 133%. So we will be looking at, once we, I'll get you through the mandatory minimum, we will then be looking at, just give you a peek of where we're going, benefits, increased eligibility, and provider payment levels will be the three levers that we'll have to investigate about how to use resources that are remaining after the mandatory program is funded. And I can take you there, and maybe this will help clarify it, but I'll stop there, and there may be questions.
Representative Greenwood.
Barney, I have two questions. First, the bottom half of this table is our current optional population, but that's not the maximum optional population that could be added under Medicaid regulations, is that right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, that is correct. That it's Oregon optional in the sense that those are the options that are currently in place and approved and operational in Oregon under the Oregon Health Plan.
Right.
But it could be more expansive under a different federal waiver.
And sometime downstream.
Pardon me?
And sometime downstream when you talk about that.
Yes.
And in fact, if we're changing it, we might pick a different set of optional ones than this set of optional ones. That's a different issue. The second question, if I may, sir. You mentioned drugs were not a required benefit in the required populations. So we switch from somebody required to be covered from what they're required to be covered for. What is the current minimum covered services for people who are currently mandated to be under Medicaid?
Hold one moment.
I didn't mean to chase you away, Bernie.
No, I'm coming back.
Here's $20. Let's leave you.
He's gone. I'm sorry I asked the question.
Let me read from it. There's a Kaiser Commission report on Medicaid, and they do list out here the mandatory services in a little more detail than I said, but the mandatory services: physician services, lab and x-ray services, inpatient hospital services, outpatient hospital services, early and periodic screening and diagnosis and treatment for individuals under 21. That's referred to as EPSDT. Basically, it's preventive care for children, youth, and young adults. Family planning services and supplies, services provided at a federally qualified health center, services provided at a rural health clinic, and those would basically be physician, nurse practitioner, allied health, and lab and x-ray, nurse midwife services, and certified nurse practitioner services. That's the list of minimums.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Just a clarification, Barney. Under the EP, the early screening diagnostic category, that does include medications and everything for kids. So that's the only place where prescription drugs are included.
Okay.
Under those, that 0 to 21 year old age, I think they include a full range, including medications on that. So, but
for that would be under the treatments side. I did not know that, and that's good to get on the record, because even at the mandatory minimum for the children that would be under the mandatory minimum, you're saying there would be a pharmacy benefit that would come to them through the EPSD route.
I believe that's true. Yes.
Okay. We will clearly look at that.
Representative Bates.
Excuse me.
I'm sorry, Maureen, to interrupt you. Just for further clarification, also for those who may not be aware. Probably most people in this room are. Just because you're supposedly covering these, historically, the pay for covering these has been much less than the actual cost. And so there is cost shift built into this, even if you cover this group. In other words, physicians and hospitals may only get 50% of the normal customary fees, which means they're not covering their costs for doing it. That cost is then shifted into the commercial market. We have to keep that in mind, what's going on here, too. And when you go into a larger group, the experience has been that the cost shift, to a degree, from that point of view has increased. However, the cost shift for people not being insured at all has decreased. So you've got these hydraulics going on all the time in this system. It's a very complicated system. So don't put in your mind that just because it's covered, it's appropriately covered. It means it's covered, but it might be at a discounted price, such as pharmacists can't take part anymore, hospitals can't take part anymore, and the providers might leave the system. So that's part of the hydraulic going on, too.
And that would be an excellent segue to take you into this budget sheet. You can see the three boxes, and let me just quickly give an overview of the three boxes and then get into the detail of particularly the middle box and the bottom box.
Don't hesitate to spend as much time as you want in the first top two boxes. This is where we are.
Right. I mean, the top box is a summary of the governor's balanced budget. And I think and you can see that it's listed by the OHP Medicaid with mental health, CHIP, that's the Children's Health Insurance Program, then a subtotal, and then there's some non-OHP programmatic requirements, and then the total governor's balanced budget. And I would point you to the column that says subtotal state fund. The operative number, the target, the challenge, is the 992.1, because that represents the sum of general fund and tobacco tax that's available in the 03-05 budget per the governor's balanced budget to deploy in an Oregon health plan program. Now I'll move down to the mandatory. So just think of that 992, set it out here as, I literally think of it this way when in the groups, is you got 992 out here, and what we're going to do is we're going to go through a series of exercises and subtract from that 992, if you will, by coverage, and there will be a remainder, and then we're going to use that remainder to deploy to buy other things, which I'll get into in a minute. The next box is the estimate of what it would cost in 03-05 to provide the mandatory population, that's this, the top of that box, the mandatory population, the mandatory minimum benefit. And I want to emphasize one of the important caveats in this number is in the parentheses after mandatory programs, and this relates directly to Representative Bates's comment, is that these numbers have no assumptions built in regarding increases in utilization in the 03-05 budget or increases in any provider reimbursement in 03-05. So they are basically flat, and potentially, because it's working off of a corrected base, could actually be potentially negative. So, but it's trying to get, if we were, what would it cost to deliver the mandatory programs to the mandatory populations? And one of the policy issues that we will go back and look, that we are going back and look at, will be what does it cost to plug in additional costs for utilization and additional costs for improved provider reimbursement. The point I would point out in this middle box is look under the subtotal of state funds. It's $728.3 million. Out of the $992.1 million buys us mandatory services for a mandatory population. What's left is $263.7 million, and where that number, you can see where it says sample options for use of surplus between mandatory and governor's balanced budget funding, parentheses 263.7, that is just the difference between 992.1 and 728.3, with it, and it's off by one decimal because of rounding. So if you're back to my mental image, I got 992, I've just subtracted 728, I've got 263.7 left, and what we went through last night was a discussion of some very large policy choices of trying to get some pricing done to understand how we can deploy that $263.7 million in state resources. And some of the policy choices that we want to price out include, for example, you can see prescription drugs for mandatory populations, general fund, $118.3 million. Now, that $118.3 million isn't an accurate figure because it doesn't have any cost or utilization figures in it. So we know that the prescription drug, to put prescription drugs back into the mandatory population, will cost more than $118.3 million. We want to know what that number is, because I think there's a consensus, I don't want to presume what consensus, but I think there's a very strong interest in having a realistic benefit design, and that a health care program in the 21st century without RX, from a physician's point of view and a patient's point of view and a policymaker's point of view, is probably doesn't make sense.
Barney, there wasn't any disagreement in the room on that, so you can assume consensus.
So
Tom Holt wasn't real.
Didn't he say he was donating a drug?
Yeah, I remember that.
There's a donation there.
Yeah.
Talk about step it up. Yeah. 300 million.
Way to go, buddy.
You're my man.
We appreciate the.
You're my man, Tom.
Yeah. Well, I think that was just Westland supply that he was talking about.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now that 118 million then. Does take into account the existing new formulary type thing that we have. Is that working? Is that going to decrease ways of dealing with the cost of drugs?
Representative Anderson, I believe that these projections are developed using the existing scenarios or tools of management. And I think there's also discussions within the administration of perhaps new tools of management. But I would answer with, and I'll check it out to make certain, but I believe the answer to your question is yes, it does.
Or to say that a different way, these assumptions were based using current law,
right,
which includes 819 and the preferred drug list as it currently exists. What that number doesn't include, as Barney was alluding to, is any type of inflation index, utilization, incidence, intensity of use, and I don't know what they call it, but it's a PricewaterhouseCoopers, you know, inflation index.
It's a trend factor.
Yeah.
It's a trend for utilization.
Which is right at 28% for managed care. So this number, if you're going to buy back pharmaceuticals, which, like I said, everyone in the group, with the exception of Tom Holt, was, you know, there's great consensus there. You know, this is a higher number, probably significantly higher, 160, 170, 180.
Okay, Mr. Chair, but since we're dealing here with a categorical population who is virtually all in capitated system, 819 isn't a big factor. Because they're already, the capitated systems already have formularies.
Yeah. Like I say, this takes current law, and then what you're getting at, I mean, that really dealt with the open card, the fee for service, which so far we haven't gotten to here.
Gotcha.
Is there another question?
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you took the fee for service in this on the pharmaceutical, for instance, you take roughly that's 30%, and then you can whittle that down a little bit by putting them under a tight formulary, but you're not going to save a huge amount. This is probably pretty realistic figures. Okay. And even if we gave that fee for service to one of the managed care plans to manage, I don't think there'd be a huge savings. There'd be some, but not huge. Okay. So this is the buybacks are probably pretty honest. Pretty close. There might be some little movement.
Well, the utilization in categorical is going to be in the managed care, the capitated side, as far as RX, probably more than in the fee-for-service side anyway.
Sorry to interrupt.
I'm Mr. Chair, I believe another member has a question before I proceed.
Who had a question?
Thank you, sir.
Representative Greenlee.
Brian, as you know, I've not worked these numbers for some time now, having other things on my mind. I'd really appreciate it if you would just share a little bit for me the issue of the relationship between the state funds and the federal funds. It seems to change based on some of these models, right? I mean, basically in the top box, you've got $1 billion in federal funds, I mean in state funds, and $2 billion in federal funds. TF is total funds?
TF is total fund.
So you've got about a 1-3 match, roughly. $1 billion plus $2 billion gives you $3 billion. Cutting down in that next box, it's a slightly different relationship, right? When you take the mandatory program, it feels like the you lose 260. You take 260 million in state funds and end up losing about $1 billion total funds. So you lose like 735.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlick, I'll look into this. I'm not aware. The only response I can give you is, and I don't think this response is sufficient to compensate for the differences that you've pointed out, is that the match rate in the top box for CHIP is a 70-30 match rate, and in Title 19, it's like 60-40. But the magnitude, you can see that number is relatively small. It's not CHIP, but I don't know exactly why that would play out. We can find out. I will, not to be glib about it.
No.
I would point out that to some extent, even if those columns are wrong, they're not the columns that are going to be driving the policy and budget. It's going to be the state fund total, and then we need to make certain we get the right match rates, so that, because that those dollars are important. But the crisis, or the paradigm within which we're working, is that, as you know, is that's 992.1 or 728.3.
Well, where I'm going with this is, and you can see it in your bottom box as you get to it, is that and this is where I was going, different options produce more or less federal funds per dollar in state funds. Let me say it as a statement. The extent to which we can use a dollar of state funds to leverage more federal funds rather than less federal funds, that seems to me a principle that we might want to have in the option principles. And there's some. I wasn't assuming these tables were wrong. I was assuming they were right. And therefore, different dollars drive different federal funds, and that may be something we want to pay attention to.
Well, and that is a principle when we talk about the leveraging of funds is critical, Principle 7.
And it shows here.
And I'll have to be honest with you, Representative Greenlake. I'm not certain, and we will make an inquiry, that if we make a choice to put a dollar into an expanded benefit, or alternatively, to put that dollar into expanded reimbursement for providers, or the third alternative, to put that dollar into an expanded eligibility for categoricals above the minimum income level, that the federal match rate changes. I do not. I've always worked under the impression that the 60-40 follows whether it's an eligibility issue or a benefits issue or a reimbursement issue. So long on the reimbursement issue, I think the feds, we have to pay reasonably, or I mean, we can't pay. Where your principle and you're most correct, and it was discussed last night and from the beginning, is to realize that the Title 21 program, the CHIP program, allows us to and we are currently covering children up to about 185%, I think, does allow us greater federal match, up 70-30, as I said. And I think there's also going to be the other side of this coin, is the choice of, are there initiatives that we feel strongly about that may not have federal match? that we want to use state-only funds. And I'll give you an example. It's come up. I'm not trying to cast whether it's a good idea or a bad idea, but it's an idea, and that is if we, as a state, feel that primary care access because of coverage contractions is important, some states are using state-only funds to buttress their safety net, to build capacity into their safety net systems. That's a choice, but it's a choice, as you point out, Representative Greenlick, that comes at a cost because there's no leverage that's going on in there. But there's a different policy objective.
Yeah, we actually had this conversation last night, and Representative Cruz had some...
Yeah, I mean, and we're right. Clearly, maximizing federal funds is a core principle here, but only to a point. And the example would be with CHIP, because we also have to do triage here, and CHIP's attractive because it's 70-30, where Medicaid's only 60-40, but would we be better? Is it a better choice to chase that additional 10 cents at 185% of federal poverty for those kids, or would we be better getting a smaller match rate so we can cover TANF at 56% of federal poverty? I mean, that's part of the triage that we're going to go through when we set out these matrices.
I may comment. It's I'm learning to wear more hats than one in this body. It's interesting, and in the day and age we're in, given the economy we have, well, I really have lived my life on the principles of how to deal with rational health care. Getting federal dollars into the state in the times of bad economy is not a bad idea if it's close. It shouldn't be the driving decision, but it is.
Mix. Yeah, it's part of the decision matrix. But keep in mind that our number one priority is serving the most vulnerable, and that triage is going to kind of be the basis of all the matrix. So,
Mr. Chair, to continue where I left off is that what you can see some examples where DHS and OMAP staff have given some examples of buying back some benefits for mandatory populations, and they're there as examples. There's no decision made about them. It's an incomplete list. Again, I want to point out that those numbers don't have utilization and cost increases built into them. So if we were to buy, as I said, prescription drugs back, we're going to get a different number for that, because to make it work, we'd have to have utilization and cost. The committee has spent last night, closed the meeting last night, by looking at this, reviewing it, talking about the assumptions behind it, and then having a discussion about what other kinds of what I would call macro estimates do we want to have developed that reflect some of the policy choices that we know we're going to be confronted with. And one I've already talked about, and that is give us a number for a realistic cost of an RX program for the mandatory population. We also want to look at what would it cost. We know that the CHIP program up here at the top is $12 million in tobacco tax, but that also doesn't have any utilization or cost in it, so we need to understand what the price of that program would be. To Dr. Bates's point, if we have a rational benefit design, but we have reimbursement levels that are inadequate to make the fully capitated health plan work, or in the fee-for-service system that drive out participation, we are concerned about that. So one of our requests is, tell us what the mandatory program would cost if we brought utilization and reimbursement forward from this zero trend to something that is represented by the consulting actuary to OMAP, understanding that we don't have to go that high, but we need to know the magnitude of getting current, and then we can back down from that. So that's the reimbursement lever, if you will. And then we clearly are going to have to look at, and Representative Cruz made the point last night, and again just momentarily, is to look at expanding populations, not only within the categoricals, but ultimately potentially in the non-categoricals. I'll give you an example, and this gets into, I think, the kind of what the stakeholder group will really grapple with near the end of its deliberations, and that is we will know how much it will cost to restore coverage for pregnant women above the 133% up to the current 185%. We will also know what it costs to have a CHIP program or to expand children's coverage. And we're going to have to look at not only the federal match rate question, but also the health policy question of if we have this limited dollars, where do we put them? Again, there's no preconceived hierarchy or answer yet, but we're just beginning to ask for the pricing questions, pricing information, so that we can have discussions across this basic. The levers are eligibility, benefits, and reimbursement. I'll stop there because that's where we concluded last night, as we put together a list, and I believe that both the OMAP DHS staff and Mr. Britton from LFO will be working on some of these questions. We probably can't get all the answers by Monday night, but we can get some of them, and then we will move through a discussion of these, and I think look at various permutations and combinations, again from the point of view, all of the points of view of federal match, vulnerable populations, keeping the core infrastructure of the delivery system in place, et cetera, if you will, using these principles as a touchstone as we look at the permutations and combinations. And based upon my knowledge of the individuals that are participating, we will have a very open and candid discussion of those. I'll stop there. That's my summary, Mr. Chair.
Very good, sir.
Mr. Chair?
Any questions? Representative March.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Barney, I assume from what you were saying, you'll have sort of the mandatory service costs and sample options costs. Once you sort of determine what would be considered a minimum standards of options that we'll add, like prescription drugs, et cetera, and then we'll run those same calculations for our Oregon option populations, maybe at different breakpoints, so say like from to 150 instead of 185 and 170 or whatever, we'll do that.
Yeah, I think that we'll look at the optional populations, and the first optionals I think we have to look at are what I call the optional mandatories. For example, we're covering pregnant women beyond the federal. We want to look at those because
right.
Those are significant policy choices that we've made that have a health policy logic to them.
Absolutely.
And then there are populations outside that group, the non-categoricals generally, and we also are looking at, we want to put on the table medically needy to understand the relationship between that population and other populations. Again, going back that this is, we got to stay within that existing resource. So I think that there will probably be an iteration of requests as we get more conversations about this of actually doing the step work that you say, 150, 175, 185.
And then follow-up. And then we'll also create some options of what would be the what-if section that you don't want to go to, but that I would like to see there is, well, okay, here's our minimum. Here's what we can cover with what we've got. And if we got more, what could we cover?
Mr. Chair, Representative March, as the group facilitator, I haven't been given that charge. But there is a logic to what you say, that if we work through some sort of prioritization process to deal with existing resources, that may be worthwhile for us to say, even if not in this biennium, but at some point in the future when there are more resources, where would be the natural first step add-ons given the choices we've made in this biennium?
Kind of a prioritized add-on
correct.
List.
That's Thanks. Correct.
That's what I would like to see. Thanks.
Let me address that, and then I'll get to Lori's question. But I see
Representative Merkley doing some back-of-the-envelope math over there, and he was out of the room when we were describing, number one, is this list of options down below. I mean, the prescription drug option, 118, medical supplies, you know, health services, addiction services, those are numbers that do not include any additional utilization or, for lack of a better term, medical inflation cost to them. So they don't include the PricewaterhouseCoopers, you know, population number, if you will. So, I mean, these are actually much more expensive, considerably more expensive to add than what is reflected here. And then that also goes back to the gap between the 992 and 728 leaves us, quote, 600 and, or I wish 600, 264, you know, million dollars to buy things back. I mean, this 264 gap is off the governor's balanced budget, which was based on, you know, good methodology at the time, you know, a 13.8% growth rate in revenues. We're not going to get that. So the informal work group was using, you know, a back of the envelope lesser number. We just picked 250. We don't know if that's right. We don't know if it's, you know, 240 or 280. But it's probably not going to be 264. It's probably going to be, you know, some multiple of 10 million dollars less than that. So you got a sword that's kind of cutting both ways. That's how you're doing that math there. Again, it's another reason I keep stressing within existing resources. You know, we've got to do what we know we can do, as unpalatable as that is. You talk about correctly. So what would be the next step, the next step after that? You know, prioritize, you know, healthcare services in the state. I think that's a good idea, but we are only going to go as far as we can go.
Just to clarify that, so what we really should be talking about is that the 992 number is not what we have to work with. We have to work with something considerably less, and in the magnitude of 10% to 20% less.
Yeah, what is a solid number is the cost of the federal minimum Medicaid services. So whatever, you know, whatever the top line number, I mean, I don't know if that's 980, 970, whatever the result is that you don't have $264 million worth of gap there. I was actually pretty pleased to see that at a bare minimum,
it was a positive number.
It was a positive number, and we can buy pharmaceuticals back. So
it's always good to buy drugs.
Yeah, I mean, not to show my bias there, but I don't know how you have a plan without pharmaceuticals. And just so everybody knows, I mean, when I wasn't really characterizing Tom Holt's position correctly. It wasn't just no to drugs. It was hell no. So the Representative Anderson.
Following up on that, Mr. Chair, I want to stay within the existing resources. A little bit different approach than my fellow colleague from Portland. But where I want to go with that is I still would love to be creative, and I'm not sure how, and this is where we need staff. We're going to have increased utilization by maybe numbers of patients, but are there ways to decrease utilization by the existing members that we have or participants that we have? For instance, when we had that pharmacy group here that, or not pharmacy, physician group here, they cut costs by decreasing the number of ER visits, okay? The other thing that they did is they decreased costs of medication. So the two areas that I'd like to see done is decreasing utilization among our members and also looking at decreasing the cost of prescription drugs for this population. So therefore, we could still stay within our existing resources.
And do more.
And do more.
Right.
Is that...
Could I respond, Mr. Chair? And in fact, Representative Anderson, that was in fact discussed last night by, and it was brought forward by Dr. Goldberg. And I think we're going to look hard at, I mean, first of all, one of the reasons that I think maintaining the core infrastructure through the organized delivery system is it gives us that management tool in communities. Secondly, Dr. Goldberg expressed the perspective, and I think it's widely shared, is that while Oregon's utilization of healthcare services is dramatically different, less, better, more conservative than other places in the country, there's still opportunities for us to use resources more wisely,
right,
like prescription drugs, like perhaps in some procedures, et cetera. And so we need to continue to push on evidence-based,
right,
protocols,
that's
standards around which medicine can support, and then we enforce them through the FCHPs, through agreement by physicians and communities that this is good medicine. We need to continue to push that. Now, in saying that, we want to do the same thing that you just described. The difficulty is going to be how you budget for that. How much? Because there's a certain degree of a wing and a prayer when you put a new management concept into a program, whether it be an administrative external or one that's internalized among physicians, of how much do you actually save. But I will assure you that I think that after we get some of these major pieces constructed, we will, based upon last night's conversation, that Dr. Goldberg and others will take us back to that to make sure that we can comment more fully on, to you, on our expectations of things that we would do in 03-05 that would make the dollar go farther.
Okay, great.
Is that a fair representation?
Yeah, okay. I think that's... Now, I don't want to diminish your and Barney's comments, because there are some things I think we can do. I mean, behavior stuff, utilization stuff, efficiencies within the system. But I think, as we're all learning on this committee, Medicaid reimbursement rates for Oregon, Medicare, we're actually doing quite a bit. I'd characterize that by saying, we do more with less than most. You can.
That's why our reimbursement rates are lower.
Yeah, this is where we got started to begin with. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the concerns that I have is that we've been working the pharmaceutical and the provider and the hospital over quite a time at cost, or sometimes a little bit above, sometimes a little bit below. Is there any thought toward fattening up the reimbursement in any way as we economize, either through eligibility slightly, as we buy pharmaceuticals at a better cost? Is there a way to assure that we're not going to lose our providers? I'm not saying make them fat cats.
No, I understand.
I'm saying we need to be thinking about keeping our providers.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, that is exactly one of the major levers on the table, because what you've precisely touched upon is that, conceivably we could spend the dollars that are available, spend within existing resources on benefits and eligibility, not make any recognition relative to provider reimbursement, and I would say particularly physician reimbursement, because they're the point of entry of access other than the hospital ED, and not have a system that's functional.
Right.
Either the FCHPs won't be able to have enough money in their capitated contract to sign a contract with community physicians and other providers, or the Oregon Health Plan or the Oregon Health Plan fee for service system would not be paying enough that providers would, if you will, participate to the level that we would like. So that's going to be one of the tough choices, because, again, that's the issue of, I think, making the system functional, that if we're going to promise a benefit, then there should be reasonable access to that benefit through the local medical community.
Right. I just follow up on that. Just, it'd be my, I'd love to see us getting greater and greater eligibility for more and more people, especially the working poor. But I think we need to be careful that as we do make some of these economy provisions, that we balance it out, as Mr. Spada said, in making it really worthwhile for the providers to stay in and work with us. They're going to make a good living on the fee for service people or for group from other insurance, but we need to be sure that this isn't losing their interest.
And what you point out is exactly true and is not accommodated for in this, you know, there's no additional reimbursement, AWP minus, you know, some other number accounted for.
But I would remind you, Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, we have asked for how much would it cost to improve the reimbursement and utilization to a more current understanding. We may not even want to go that far, but sure, we may have to look at, as Representative March characterized it, steps of, sure, if we're here now, what would it cost, and you know, this would be totally current, how much would it cost to buy up some of those steps that would help providers mitigate their operational losses in payment.
Representative Cruz.
Yeah, I don't want anybody here to fall under the trap of the wonderful things we can or cannot do. Keep in mind, in the top box, top general fund dollars, the governor's recommended budget, that's an assuming an almost 14% revenue increase, which is not reality. You know, so if we reduce that number, whatever we have to reduce that number reduces the pot of money that we have between mandated and any ads we do. So the job one here, quite clearly, is to save the system. What we can do as enhancements above what is absolutely required is going to be problematic, and to a degree based on revenue, and we don't know the answers to those things yet. So, well, and tobacco taxes are too, but you know, that's fairly static, and we can assume that number. But the general fund, we have no idea what that's going to be, and won't for a while. But except that we do know that it's going to be significantly lower than what's in the governor's recommended. So, you know, I'm not a prognosticator, but I'm not seeing an uptick in May at this point in time. So you know, we're triaging the whole system right now. Any ads will come when we have a little more certainty of numbers.
This is tough, folks. Any other questions? Representative Greenland.
Can I play just a little more on those numbers that are still puzzling me? Because I wonder if it's something in the other funds line that's at issue back in that other box. The 992 is 30% of the 2977. And the 728 is 37% of the 1983. So something's happening in those numbers. And the reason I'm interested is I'm looking for a clue in what's going on in those other funds. That's obviously the only place that it could happen.
Rick?
And, Barney, perhaps you can reflect. Maybe under the OHP Medicaid with mental health, we don't get full Medicaid benefit for anybody but 0 to 21 and 64 up. Does that basically change some of those figures in that line that might impact?
Is that tobacco?
I don't know. I think we need to understand what Representative Greenlicht has pointed out. Right. And, I mean, assuming it to be accurate, the question is why?
Why? And then is there something we can do with that?
Right.
Why? Is
correct.
There a source of funds in there, in other funds, that we can use to get something?
And we'll clearly look into that in my next report. I'll try to specifically bullet point that and get back to you.
Yeah, good catch.
Mr. Chair, I'm just not here, but I'm thinking it was it was the tobacco change, but I may be wrong about that. I want to go back and recheck it. I remember we asked that question the other night, and there was a logical explanation
for
it.
What Representative Greenlick is pointing out, Representative Bates, is the relationship of 728.3, which is the sum of general fund and tobacco tax. That's relationship to total funds is higher than the 992.1 to the total funds in.
I understand. And the difference is other funds.
And
in my memory of it, it has something to do with the tobacco changes, and I can't.
We'll get to that, though, because I think it at least needs to be answered rationally. It may be explained. Hopefully, it's explainable. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I look forward to continuing to work with you and Representative Cruz and the committee, and we'll be back here probably next week.
We'll have weekly updates every Thursday. We will get, I don't know if we're working into Thursday. I kind of like to make Thursday the facilitator day and get the update on mental health as well from Jeff Guilfoy. Am I getting that right? Anyway, any other questions?
We have a very helpful summary.
Yeah, I mean, hey, this is it. I mean, we're hanging it all out there for you. So, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Seeing no other business coming before the committee, we are adjourned.